Hello, it's 3:31 p.m. on August 26, 2013, here on the Pacific coast of North America. This is Pacific Daylight Time, so they tell me. Number of items to run through here really quick. Actually a number of them are all interrelated too. Let's start with Ice Age, which of course is interrelated with our weather issues later on. The indications are stacking up in our data that there's going to be a sudden weather shift for North America, out of the blue. It'll be a rather abrupt change, sudden shift into winter without a segue through fall, apparently. Just something to be aware of. It relates to the oscillation and the sharpness of the oscillation that between hot and cold that leads us into an ice age. And that's related to the expansion of the planet, which is related also to where we are within the helical cone behind the sun, bearing in mind, of course, that the Earth has never ever orbited the sun. We, in fact, trail behind it. And any real astronomer will tell you this. Even the bad ones are aware of this. They just can't figure out a way to express it well, to get the idea across. But basically, our position within the cone behind the sun is determines and is determined by our size, and Earth is expanding. This expansion may or may not be associated with the sudden shift in weather, but it's temporally linked because it occurs at the same time. The next big expansion phase occurs at the same time that we shift into this sharpness in the oscillation and climate. And the expansion of the planet is what we're seeing now in the form of sinkholes. Oddly enough, people don't associate sinking with the expansion of the planet, but also the whirlpools that are off the in the Atlantic, as well as the iron plume that's coming from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, as well as the volcano activity along the Pacific Rim of Fire, and the sinkholes and tears in the continents. These are all signs of the expansion of the planet, as the as our feet would tell us, the planet is solid, but it's not really. It's composed, even at the crust level, of all these bits that are just sort of held together by mutual attraction. And as pressure is exerted from the middle of the planet outward, as new material is created within the plasma core of the planet due to the influx of energy from the sun, and the sun being in a very excited state, for these last 15, 18 years, really excited, but 40 or 50 years, it's been gradually getting excited. Anyway, the sun gives us more energy. It goes into the central core of our plasma reactor that is the middle of the planet. It's not molten iron. That's a bunch of hooey. And this plasma generates the magnetic field of the planet, and it gets a little wonky as it has to take some of that energy and create matter out of it. It creates matter of all kinds, and it shoves it away from itself into the planet that we have under our feet, and that matter has to go somewhere, so it makes other matter that it previously existed move and spread apart. And this ultimately leads to sinkholes and volcanic eruptions and so on. The volcanic eruptions, it's sort of easy to see because the matter gets hot as it's pushed up through the various holes and cracks in the crust and the mantle. And it's got to come out, and when it comes out, it's a little bit irritated, and it comes out hot and bothered. And so it comes out in the form of the volcanoes. And that's because it's sort of like a pressure cooker, only not water and steam, but, you know, molten rock. The sinkholes are harder for people to understand, but basically what happens is underneath the surface layers of the planet at a deeper level, big chunks separate. The big chunks separate as the pressure is pushing on them from below. And sometimes when these big chunks separate, it causes a gap that is not immediately filled by material underneath the big chunks. And so parts of the mantles and the crust sag. And in sagging, they sort of stay there for a while in these sort of latticed framework. And then these lattices will, in many cases, they'll collapse as the bits and pieces move further away from each other. When these collapse, the final layer of the upper layer of the planet that we see as that our feet tell us is the solid bits, which includes, you know, our topsoil and the oceans and all of that kind of stuff, will develop holes. And these holes, sometimes they're directly over the separation of the big chunks. Other times they could be hundreds of miles away, depending on how the crust accommodates and shifts and this sort of thing in terms of, you know, the sinkhole actually could suck stuff straight down into one of these giant gaps. So it might extend literally down thousands of feet, perhaps, who knows. Or it could extend down only 40 or 50 feet as the topsoil sinks into one of these gaps and fills it, or meets material rising from below and stops sinking. So there's the sinkhole that we have in off the coast of Louisiana, and I think that one is in contact with one of these very deep holes, and it's going to keep growing. It's just going to keep expanding and sucking more and more of the delta area in. And it's going to start taking in larger and larger chunks of land and still remain more or less liquid-filled for a long time. And this process sort of makes sense when you looked at the issues of what's being created by the inner core of the planet and how much water is being created. It's a significant issue. So, for instance, if we examine the iron plume that's coming out of the mid-Atlantic, that just happens to be an area where the plasma effect had reached as high as the ferric metals, ferric metal, ferrous, and created that. The combination of the energy and the various materials that are near the plasma core, the pressure levels and so on, to a certain extent determines, or totally determines the level of excitement of the plasma and the output. And the plasma in a highly excited state is going to be producing a number of different minerals, elements, as it goes through the process here. And there are other components, and that is that there's streaks, if you will, sort of like the Kimberley Plateau diamond hole, a volcanic tube that was just filled with diamonds. We'll find tubes that are filled with, just jam-packed with, you know, cobalt or copper, or in this case, iron, molybdenum, and these kind of minerals, because this is the way in which these minerals are formed. Under the pressure, they sort of like squirt out in these long, from cavernous areas filled with basically solutions, if you will, of lesser grade material that's under pressure, and then the plasma produces more of it, and it goes on to the final stages of producing whatever particular element that it's involved with the creation of. So the precursor to the iron is put under pressure by the plasma, and we get these long plumes coming out of the mid-Atlantic, and I would postulate that it's even more amazing. If we could strip away the rest of the planet temporarily, we would see that the plume coming out in the mid-Atlantic may extend down several hundred miles, perhaps maybe 600 or even 700 miles, down into the deeper parts of the planet to a pocket of magma-pressured material that's in the process of becoming iron. And that's what we're actually seeing up at the top is just sort of a tendril that's releasing the pressure. And it's coming out in the form of this long spew of iron in the mid-Atlantic. Now, we've seen other episodes of this in rivers. We've seen episodes of this in India and the Indian subcontinent. A particularly interesting area because of where it butts up against the Himalayas. And the mineral wealth that's found in Kashmir, which is this little small space in the triangular area of northern India smacking into the Eurasian continent. And it is as though there was a void formed when this occurred, when the split actually occurred that separated these two parts of the landmass, because they didn't smack into each other. They're actually withdrawing from each other as the Earth expands. And as it does so, it's created this void that we can call Kashmir, and it's just a super mineral-rich area, because in so creating that void, it allowed for a number of these bolides or pockets of nascent mineral wealth to be able to find release from the pressure of the plasma underneath them by being able to extrude or expel their minerals up through the area that we now know as Kashmir. Many of the veins, for instance, in Kashmir, the veins of minerals are essentially vertical, and they don't have any layering effect, so they're very new. And by the way, this is what we're seeing in the mid-Atlantic, is how the oceans are, the bottom of the ocean is formed. This is why we find that the bottom of the ocean is considerably younger than the continents. So the continents don't float on a planet and shift around. They are, in fact, the older part of the planet, and it's the oceans that it's the newest part. So if we looked at it one way, we have a particular affinity within the plasma of our planet for the creation of water, because over time from Earth's inception, it was originally 60 or 80%, I mean, it was way smaller. Then it got to be about 60 or 80% smaller than it is now, and all the continents fit together, and there were just a few lakes here and there. And that's when the dinosaurs were trucking around, and they had a good time. And they had very much lower gravity at the time. Had no moon. Moon was parked here later. Anyway, the planet started to expand as its plasma core started producing more and more material. It shattered the continents and created these big rifts. And then eventually over time, the rifts, every time we went into an expansion episode, the rifts would grow, and they would also fill with water. Because the planet liked to create water, it's easy to create helium and hydrogen and oxygen and the other gases, and then smash them all together and get water. With the pressure of the plasma and the magma, the heat, and so on. And so it's an easy out. It's an easy mineral or element to create. The hydrogen, which leads us to the creation of the water. And so over time, I would suspect that we're going to be, if we were at, you know, 68% of the planet was ocean, you know, 15,000 years ago, and 70% of the planet is ocean now, then the next, as we get through this expansion period, it may well be that from a physical measured viewpoint of the planet itself, while the continents won't have shrunk, the oceans will have grown, and so the proportion will have changed, and we might be 73 or 74 or 75% ocean, and the rest land. And so over time, the amount of land will decrease as our planet has, as I say, as it seems to have an affinity for creating oceans and, of water. And actually, I like this. Oceans of water are good things. I'm actually less worried now about the methane issue, because I don't think that the planet is stationary or stable in that sense. And thus, the production and the release of the methane is going to occur with or without any kind of a albedo change in the planet. I believe it would change, would be released if it was going to, as a result of the pressure if we went into a heating episode, extreme heating episode, within the core of the planet. I don't think that this will occur, because it apparently has not occurred, except way in the far past, there was evidence of a giant methane release when the oceans were very young. And it also appears that at that time, the oceans were also highly saturated with methane in a way that they are not now. And so during that expansion episode, which might have been millions of years ago for all I know, but during that expansion episode, methane was released in quantity. And there's a lot of guys that's in the anthropology business and so on that say that this participated in the distinction of this particular layer of land mammals or land animals. Mostly invertebrates, actually, that existed at the time. And it may be If you think about this appropriately, you'll recognize that, we didn't crawl out of the ocean because in terms of creating us or creating any life, life existed on the dry land because there were no oceans at one point. There were just a few lakes. And then the planet broke up a bit and their lakes drained into some ravines. And eventually the planet created more water and they became inland seas and then, really large lakes and then inland seas and then a lot of big oceans. And so we make a lot of stupid assumptions as primates that, for instance, the oceans were here first. And that is not the case. All the water is new. All the land is old. All the bottom of the ocean is new. All the further down you drill in continents, the older the crap gets. Until you reach a certain point, and then you start becoming, then you start finding new material. That is to say, newer minerals that are not as weathered or aged as the stuff on the surface. And so you realize you've gone through it at that point into the abiotic new material, the way that the Russians are drilling into the deep oil. To continue with this idea, as the planet expands and the sinkholes drop in, some of them are going to drop to the point where they connect directly to these giant gaps between the huge sections of the subcrustal areas, and we're going to get some rather startling effects. Some of those may indeed be the loss of buildings. I hesitate to think it's going to be as large as whole cities, but it well could be. We indeed may see and probably will see subsidence at a vast level. But by that I would mean, if we were in North America, it might be that, say, giant tracts of area between the Appalachians and the Rockies settle down even further relative to their current altitude by sinking in. So you might have something that's, several hundred kilometers wide by several thousand kilometers long that just drops 20 feet. I don't think it would be quite suddenly, but it would be catastrophic and would be quite noticeable and very visible. And I'm sure we'll see some elements of that, whether it'll be 1,000 miles long or not. I don't know, because it's impossible, I think, at this point, for someone on the outside of deep government to be able to predict the level of the expansion event we're in. Not all expansion events are equal. There appears to be at least a trivalent sort of irregular three-sided pendulum variance in the violence and the problems caused by the expansion periods. So they may know much more than us and be able to predict just exactly how nasty it's going to be. Strikes me as kind of silly to be spending all this time and money burrowing into the ground if the crust is going to be changing and heaving and cracking and that kind of stuff. So at some level, they are not aware of, or they figure they've got a technology that trumps the ability of the planet to shift in its expansion mode. Anyway, so we've got this expansion stuff going on, coincident with an ice age. I don't think that there's a causal relationship between either. I know that we're at the end of a particular 100,000-year, it's actually 108,000-year cycle, in which we go into an ice age. Now, at the same time, we just happen to be in an expansion event. In previous ice ages, there is no evidence that there were expansion events ongoing. So some of the other effects don't appear to have occurred at the same time as expansion event. But this is rather interesting that we're getting both at the same time. I've recently run across some information relative to the expansion event and this kind of ancillary stuff from a Sumerian viewpoint that put me into contact with this group called the Oriental Institute, which you can find online, and I think they're a .org, orientalinstitute.org. Anyway, you can look them up at Google. And they've got a program they call CAD. And CAD is the word-by-word translation of all of the Sumerian text. And you can do word searches on them in English. It's very easy at this stage, using their particular resources, to go through and research some of these ancient documents and see things in a much more factual light, especially about issues relative to ice ages and the whole deal of Planet X and all this kind of thing. When it turns out that this guy Sitchin was he was working somebody's agenda and or was a huge egomaniac that was in either case, regardless of whatever his motivation was, he was a lying son of a bitch. If you go and look, you'll find that in all of the Sumerian texts, and they've got tens of thousands of these cuneiform documents, including the ones that Sitchin claims to have translated, which I would beg to differ, he did not. But in any event, including those he claims to have translated, all of these are now searchable on a word-by-word basis, on a word-by-word translation. And so you can hunt for Nibiru, and you're going to find remarkably that Sitchin was a lying son of a bitch. There are no connections between the word Nibiru and any tablet containing anything about the Anunnaki. None. There's no connection between the word Nibiru on any tablet, and have that same tablet also in any way, shape, or form reference the Anunnaki. So their connection is bogus. It only existed in Sitchin's head. There's no connection between Nibiru and the mineral gold. None. There's no verbal connection on any tablet that has the word Nibiru. In fact, out of all of these tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets that have been translated, Nibiru appears some 20 times. 17 of those times, it's clearly associated in a astrologic sense with the planet Jupiter. And they're discussing the astrology of Jupiter, and they call it Nibiru when they're discussing it in an astrological sense, as opposed to an astronomic sense. In one of the other times, Nibiru is used in mistakenly, I think, in connection with the word with the planet Mercury. And then in another time, they use it to say that there's going to be an alignment between Earth, Nibiru, and this polar star. And at that point, again, they were talking about this astrological alignment and its impact on the people. And that's it. I mean, like, Sitchin was just, you know, so full of shit. It's just, it's a wonder the flies didn't just land on him constantly. But at the time he did it, of course, it was not possible to contradict him. His stuff was taken as the absolute, you know, authority, because he so proclaimed himself being a 32nd degree Mason. He had that in him, and he proclaimed himself the authority and said, this is the way it is, and you know, then he never ever gave any references to specific passages for translations. They were always extremely vague and misleading. So, having gone through the translated Sumerian material, it's like, wait a second, Sitchin's a lying son of a bitch. That really puts a big dent in the whole Planet X thing, too. It, like, really makes it very bogus. There is no long-term orbit issue. There's no 3,600-year orbit for the Nibiru. The whole thing is entirely in Sitchin's pointy little head. You know, he's dead, but he deserves to be hauled out of his grave and bitch-slapped. Because he was, like I say, I think he was working somebody's agenda. I think he was told precisely what to say and how to say it in order to create just the effect that he did. But in any event, there is no validity in any of the Sumerian texts that relates the Anunnaki, gold, Planet X, and Earth in any way, shape, or form the way that Sitchin, described it. And so everybody who bases their particular view of the, what's going on in our solar system at the moment, on the idea that there's this Nibiru Planet X thing floating through, they don't have a leg to stand on. And if they're going to do that, they need to abandon Sitchin and go look at that source material, because Sitchin is a lying son of a bitch. In any event, that also blows to hell all this Nancy Lederhosen woman's thing too. There's no Planet X. You know, if you're basing it on Planet X, you're talking about Sitchin, and Sitchin was a lying son of a bitch. So you don't have a leg to stand on. And so Nancy Leder and Lederhosen here and her people, you know, they're just off in their own delusion and having a good time killing dogs, I hear. But you know, that isn't so cool. Other than that, as long as they're not going to harm individuals, they can be as whacked out as they want, but there's no Planet X. It ain't coming through, and Sitchin was a lying son of a bitch. So I think we've pretty much covered the Sitchin was a lying son of a bitch part of things, and we can move on to this, that, you know, Nancy Leder, Hosen, is about as cracked as her dried-out old pants, and she's just whacked-out crazy. Now, of course, you know, she is also either... extremely mentally ill, because she, or she's a collaborator. We can't have it either way. She is in telepathic, enslavement to this, group that she calls the gray aliens from Zeta Reticuli or something, right? And so, she claims to be telepathically under their control. Now, if they exist, then she's a collaborator because she's willingly doing this. And so you can't believe a thing she's saying because she's collaborating with evil space aliens if they exist. If they don't exist and or they're not in contact, they do exist and they're not in contact with her. In other words, she's totally delusional. Well, then she's totally delusional and you can't believe a thing she's saying because she's totally delusional. So she's either collaborating with, you know, evil space aliens if they exist, or she's totally delusional. In either case, you better watch out, you know, if you decide you're going to listen to what she's saying. Just like with Sitchin, you know, especially since she bases a lot of her crap on him, you know, she's standing on the shoulders of a big dead lion son of a bitch. So that's where we are. Now, you know, Nancy Lederhosen and these other Sitchin suck-ups will say, well, but hey, look at all of the crap that's happening, you know, and I got pictures of this Planet X. Well, no, they don't have any pictures of Planet X, and every single one of them was presented have fatal flaws in terms of the photography and can be demonstrated at the time. But there are indeed Earth changes going on. Now, the Earth changes are explainable because the planet's expanding as we shift back in the cone in our helical model understanding of how the solar system works. The sun's dragging us behind it the way a comet drags its debris behind it, the way that the comet Ison is supposedly dragging all this dust and debris, according to NASA, that obscures it. We are dragged behind the sun. It's the same, it's an analog one to the other. It's, you know, as above, so below. If it works at a higher level, it scales downward or upward. And the fact of the matter is that if you got to have comets within our solar system, then our solar system is a comet. A comet is is the model for the whole universe at the moment. The whole material galaxy that we can see is basically operating on the idea that we're all comets. In fact, Earth even has a coma, as the NASA even admits. You can go look it up on their site. Now, bear in mind, NASA is opposed to people that are very much like Sitchin, and that is to say that NASA, which used to be a really cool place, is basically filled with lying sons of bitches. So you got to watch out what you're taking from them. You need to look at raw data and make your own understanding, and don't listen to any of their conclusions, because like Sitchin, they're lying sons of bitches. Anyway, so now the Nancy Lederhosen's understanding, you know, as a collaborator or as a Looney Tune, is wrong. It does not exist. It ain't going to happen. All of the stuff that's ongoing is every bit as catastrophic as they may be portraying, but it does not relate to Planet X. There is no great destroyer going to go through or any of this kind of shit. It's not going to happen that way. What's going on is this relatively predictable expansion of the planet as the solar system goes through these relatively predictable upheavals that occur on these particular cycles. All of these cycles at the moment happen to be coinciding and coming to a rather spectacular degree of synchronicity for us, the little humans living on planet Earth, as it goes through all of these real problems. So what do we expect? Well, we expect a sudden shift in the weather planet-wide, so there'll be very few little segue between summer and winter. It'll just be basically between you know, hot and dry and hot and wet, or hot and dry and cold and wet, or cold and dry. I mean, it'll just be real sharp delineations. It's going to be rather nasty winter. I think a very exceptionally nasty winter. A nasty winter so bad that It'll be one of those living memory kind of things. So, from our viewpoint, and that means that, you know, in 2041, if you're still alive, you'll say to the people around you, well, yeah, it's kind of bad this year, but hey, it was nothing like it was in 2013. Let me tell you about that year. And then you're going in and, you know, just tell what little impression that your particular segment of this upcoming winter was like. That's really, truly what we expect here. And I've been hustling my ass off and trying to get all kinds of things done before that weather clamps down on us, because here in the Pacific Northwest, it's like going into a tunnel. I suspect that we'll hit some kind of a rainy patch here that will be exceptional even for us. And it'll either be exceptional in the amount of rain that comes down in a short period of time or the duration. And we may go for all-time records. So we may start raining and just not stop for, you know, 100-plus days. Our record here, by the way, is 104 days of rain out of 110 calendar days. And I think we may beat it. Or we may go the other route. The intensity appears to be ratcheting up in the rain. So it may go the other route, that when we hit winter here, it'll just be from one day to the next, if a segue out of the Indian summer, we'll just have a nice sunset. And then the next morning, it'll just be raining like all hell. And we'll get rain and snow levels like nobody's ever seen in this environment in living memory. And so that's kind of what we're preparing for in our section of North America, in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, north of, say, the 30th parallel, Eurasia or not, I would suggest that you prepare for this kind of winter if you're given the opportunity. You know, put away a little extra firewood, get a little extra food set aside, patch that hole in the roof that's been annoying you. That's actually what I've been doing today. I wear safety gear. It's advisable. And by the way, my little five-finger shoes where your toes are free to move around really are great for roofing. Especially the things they call Komodo dragon feet from Vibram. Those shoes were just really rock solid on our metal roof, even when it was wet. Of course, as I say, I've got, you know, climbing gear, safety harness, you know, rappelling gear, ascenders, the whole thing. So I'm quite solid up there. Don't do this kind of stuff and be stupid about it. But take care, but certainly see to your environment. If you haven't prepared for winter before, this may be a time to take it up as a hobby, because we're getting into a period where it'll become really serious. This particular level of seriousness has been shown in our data for, I don't know, the last three or four runs, and we're still getting the data streams in, and they're still showing every level of growth in that set as being reduced by what we see now in terms of the growth of these particular sets relative to bad weather and impacts. And we are not done with the flooding. Flooding is going to really pour out this winter, according to our data sets. And I'm of the opinion that it's going to come out both in terms of rain and also in the form of some primal water out of, you know, volcanoes in the middle of the ocean and stuff. So there's such that we'll be dealing with a lot of water from both sides, so to speak. So, any event, something to think about. We're getting into the part of the expansion event where we'll see a larger or a growth in the intensity as well as the magnitude. And so the intensity of all of the episodes of the expansion will be sharper. There'll be a higher level of intensity, just as the weather will seemingly be more intense when it hits and sharper. But we're also, in the sense of the expansion event, going to see larger magnitudes involved, magnitude of areas. So where before we might have seen, you know, a small sinkhole that that ate a hotel in Florida, now we might be coming up to the point where very large areas might collapse 15 or 20 feet, and that might ripple on for days or weeks as the new levels are sought across vast areas of property. In many cases, that'll be the end result. It won't sink anymore. But, of course, in some cases, your building will be toast by then and the damage will be done. And you'll be afraid to live there anyway because you won't know if it's going to continue. And it will be a rather frightening event. Those kind of things I expect to really ramp up over this next year or so, 19 months. Let's see. Now, ISON, getting back to comets. ISON's going to be trucking around and be real close to us here in December. And if you go to YouTube and have a look, there's a bunch of people debating just exactly what the hell ISON is, but there's very little debate from the non-NASA community that it's a comet, because it sure don't look like a comet, not from any of the photos that NASA has taken and provided. And their raw data photos don't match up with their composites and their conclusion photos. So, and we also have to bear in mind, you know, that NASA, like Sitchin, is composed largely, anymore, insofar as the what we the public get to hear, of lying sons of bitches. And so, since they are lying sons of bitches, you don't want to believe their particular conclusions about stuff. But look at the raw data that's being proffered on YouTube. And even on the Bad Astronomy Forum site, where they're attempting to debunk some of this, and go and look at the arguments, and you see that the really the arguments don't have a whole lot to stand on, and it's awful hard to debunk the raw data being presented by the various different views from Hubble. And yeah, I understand the concept of parallax, and no, I don't think it applies, and I think they screwed themselves by citing that, because they're not citing it on anything else. And the parallax is not visible in any of the other photos they're providing. In any event, though, also there's this other issue, and that is that the tuple or triplet component sectional shape of ISON really makes it hard for NASA's idea of parallax to stand up, because there ought to be different levels of drag if it's three separate objects. If it's one object being seen from three separate angles, then there ought to be three separate angles of debris behind it, sort of like the debunking the Nancy Lederhosen double sun pictures. Because if you look at all of those, I've looked at lots of them by now, probably thousands of them, but if you look at them, you'll see that there are not two light sources. There's not two sets of shadows. There's not two sets of reflections. There's not two sets of camera anomalies, you know, ghosting images, or any of these other things. There's usually only one. And so usually you're looking at some sort of a lens flare, or especially a digital enhancement of that. So under the circumstances, we've got that same kind of effect going on with what NASA is claiming relative to ISON. And of course, it's really, really fucking curious that it's named ISON, which of course is, you know, S could be easily S-I-O-N and Zion. And we're in the 2012 Olympic period, which was all Zion up. And, you know, the Zionistic bastards are getting all whipped up at the moment anyway. And it's kind of like these guys are a bunch of coneheads, and they're starting to vibrate as their moons line up. And in this case, their particular moon is this comet, which I don't think it's a comet myself. I don't know that it's a Klingon battle fleet, but here is something. If whatever it is, there's two of the things already here parked around the sun. And there's another video, and I've got a link to it on my site at Half Past Human. I think off in one of the little columns on the right, one of the little boxes on the right. Anyway, I've got a link to this video that shows two of these other triangular or tuplet creatures, or whatever the hell they are, spaceships, sitting waiting in this parked around the sun. I say waiting, that's a term I'm applying, but they may well be waiting for the showing up of this third one of that's in the comet ISON. That we've labeled ISON. So it's going to be really interesting, because that critter will be here December-ish, and we should get more and more info the closer it gets. It's whipped by the closest part of Mars. Now, presumably, if the breakaway civilization has Mars bases, they know a lot more about it than we do, because they're able to get a closer view and so on. But who knows, really? And they certainly are not sharing that with us. If they indeed have a better view of things. Hang on a second. I've got to hydrate here. It's rather exhausting to go and work on roofing, especially at the angle of our roof pitch. Anyway, so that ISON thing is really curious. It'll, as I say, be here in early part of winter. And will join in with the rest of the fun stuff that's also going to be occurring this winter. Now, coincidentally to occurring this winter, and actually it's around September 15th from our viewpoint, I didn't know that they were going to do their... the Fed was going to stop peeing money, shake its dick dry and stop this whole thing on September 14th. All I knew was that back 3 or 4 months, we started showing that there was going to be a real hiccup in the get-along relative to the financial system. It's hard to know. Relative to the debt-based currency system. Around the mid-September. And we didn't know at that time, and this was like, when I first started getting hints of it, was like probably April or May. And so we didn't know then really when in December it was going to go, but now we think it's right around the 14th, give or take 3 days. And we're going to get some very interesting effects. Now, part of this interesting effect stuff that we saw was going to be a wealth shift. Sudden, rapid wealth shift. And those particular words are going to pop up, this shift of wealth. And it's going to be a shift from one group to another. It's actually already occurred in the sense that if you're not already a participant in these things, then it's very unlikely you'll be part of the wealth shift simply because the items are going to be very difficult to obtain. And these are the things like gold, silver, Bitcoin, and other items. There's a lot of other smaller things in there, like rhodium, for instance. There's apparently going to be a big issue around rhodium and purity, and I would watch out for sponges. The sponges are going to be tainted somehow. I don't know exactly what the tainting on the sponge is relative to the rhodium. I mean, I know that they store rhodium in sponges as opposed to bars. I mean, you get bars of the stuff, but there's a lot of this industrial use of the stuff in these little plastic bottle things. So we've got to have some kind of a glitch in the system there relative to rhodium, and there's going to be some damage in the sponge, or it's going to be unusable or whatever. But for instance, rhodium's going to have its own particular set of pressures because our data suggested that there was going to be this problem that would remove some of the level of supply, thus making what was left that much more valuable. And that same sort of thing is going to occur in gold. And again, it's already happened. If you don't have your gold coin, you're not likely to get it because everybody else is already scrambling to get one themselves. And the banksters are trying to get vast quantities because they owe lots of people. That's going to be something else. In our next report, we're going to go into it. But some of these banksters have really pissed off some of the wrong people. And it's going to be, how do we want to say this? You don't want to piss off certain levels of businessmen. All right? Even bankers and banksters. They just don't want to piss these guys off. And they have. And these guys are going to be very pointed in how they're going to express their disapproval of and their irritation. Anyway, though, if you can get hold of a Bitcoin, wouldn't hurt you. If you can get hold of it doesn't matter what you pay for it. I mean, even, several hundred dollars in cost for a Bitcoin soon will be looked at as absolutely trivial. Absolutely trivial. I mean, beyond understanding how trivial. So it's the same situation with gold. Not quite the same situation with silver because of something else that's going to occur relative to silver. Silver's going to, I think, be the first point where we get a panic, and they'll start associating the panic word to the silver purchases. People are in a panic to buy silver, that kind of thing. Anyway, it's going to be real interesting. The whole of this stuff is going to start around the 14th of September. We've been running the data sets continuously, punching through the IP problems, which you've seen even more recently with the German Bundesbörse. They went down for an hour. The Nasdaq's down 3 hours. Shit's happening all over, and we're fighting it. If you talk to any IT guy, they'll tell you that it's not just yesterday. It's continuous. It's today. It's the day before. It'll probably be tomorrow. And so it's a new world out there, and we're still punching the holes through the with our IP and still retrieving data. And so we expect to have a new report out in September. Hopefully, I would say hopefully by mid-September. It's going to be very interesting, though, because the data sets are already giving us a bunch of clues as to the level of the ride that we're all going to be in for relative to the sudden onset of winter and the winter-like conditions in the fiscal system or the debt-based currency system. And then also the winter-like conditions, if you will, in our solar system. Now, winter in our solar system actually means things heat up, not cool down. It's just that it's going to be difficult times for us. And who knows what Ison is. But I don't think it's a comet, and I don't think we have to worry about it causing too much problem with the sun and drawing out real big problems. I think that's really about it. Trying to get a lot of stuff done here and get ready for the upcoming weather changes, the planetary expansion. And by the way, there are some ways to know if you're on an area that's likely to have big, giant sinkholes. And if there are, if there's a potential for your kind of an area to suffer these effects. It'll rapidly transpire over, say, 19 or 20 months, and then we'll sort of, I think, ramp down. We'll know how close we are to the peak in these next 19 or 20 months. But so, for instance, you can go and look at the geology and find out that certain areas of the planet are really solid, like Canada, some parts of the Arctic, oddly enough, parts of the North Africa under the Sahara. Parts of Eurasia, Siberia, this kind of thing. They're some of the proto-continents, and they have yet to crack up. So those areas are not likely to have sinkholes form. But a lot of other areas, including the place I'm at here in the Pacific Northwest, it's all, broken up parts of the planet already. And we broke up originally in these chunks that we're in all currently due to previous expansions. So when these new expansions occur, we can expect old ruptures to continue and so on. So if you go get a map and you look up Puget Sound and Hood Canal, here in the Pacific Northwest of, North America in Washington State, you'll see basically it's, Vancouver Island, all the San Juan Islands. It's just a bunch of tearing and fracturing of the West Coast here. And I suspect being right down here in Olympia, which is the very southernmost part of Puget Sound, like in the, what we call the, euphemistically and laughingly, the, we're the, Riviera of Puget Sound. But I suspect that the tears will continue and continue to rip on. And, it's like, okay, rip on, guys. And, I really do think that as part of the expansion, that areas near me will start to separate and we'll see bigger rifts and tears and what were river valleys, which are basically sunken down areas, bear in mind, that sort of continue and feed into these long channels that are the Puget Sound. But what were the river valleys, I think, will sink even further and become, parts of the new southern Puget Sound that will extend far further south than I am here in Olympia. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how all this plays out and how rapid it all unfolds. But there's a lot to suggest that it happens very rapidly once the expansion process begins. That once you've unlocked certain chunks, all the other chunks are freer to move and they move more rapidly. And once they've moved, then other chunks move. It's kind of like the whole calving process in glacier separations and this sort of thing. And just because all the glaciers are melting, don't think that that means we're not going into an ice age. In fact, it is a sure sign we're going into an ice age because it means the planet is providing heat from below, melting all of this material, which is going to go into new water. The new water is going to cycle in and really affect the rain cycle, and just new areas will become glaciated and will lose old areas. That's really the only part of the process that's changed or ongoing. One last thing here before I wrap up and tend to more chores is that there's all the, let's start World War III bullshit coming from Obozo and, he's just a minion of the powers that be and the Zionist banksters. They got to have a war in order to fog all of our memories as to how badly we've been raped by them. And so, and they want to kill a bunch of us off and scare the rest of us and freak our minds out and traumatize us. And then they'll figure they'll start it all up again when the war is over. Well, so they started World War One. They started World War Two. They did Korea, all of this kind of business, Vietnam, Gulf War One, Two, you know, Gulf War Three that they're trying to get going now, the attack Syria, all of this stuff. And it's like they want to get World War III going, and I say to myself, well, the data doesn't show that it's going to be all that successful, and why? Well, there's something, there truly is something different this time. It's a different world that we all exist in now. And so for whatever reason, for whatever collection of reasons, our data sets in the World War III area they grew to a certain extent, and then they just sort of like leveled off and flattened off. And so in that sense, I don't know if they're going to be able to do cruise missiles and harm Syria more. I don't know what's going to happen there relative to the fucking government. And that's their official name, by the way, fucking government. And the lying bastards that work for them. The data would suggest that if they do intend to have a World War III develop, it probably is going to be short-circuited either by the arrival of, you know, Klingon battle fleet in the form of Comet Ison and the two ones that are already here, and so we'll have something else to worry about, including the, blood-sucking bug bladder beast from the planet Thrall kind of thing, the Earth expansion problems may short-circuit their particular sets of desires by causing all kinds of problems that force the attention of the powers that be and the minions in different directions. But the data's, while unclear as to causal elements, it does point to certain trend lines that are developing. So our forecast here at the moment is that in spite of the push for World War III, the data doesn't show it as being all that successful. And that we're going to have a whole lot of problems to deal with here in the short term, and the short term begins more or less on the 14th of September, plus or minus 3 days. Now, like I say, as said when I started this, coincidentally, I didn't know that was when they're going to do their tapering off, and, you know, they're going to stop peeing money, pull their dick in and put it back in their pants. But they're going to do that. Boy, is it going to have some weird results. Anyway, hang on to your Bitcoin. Take your gold coin out and, say, happy to see you. Here's the light of day, your time is coming. And take your two silver coins out and bump them together and, maybe they'll have children for you. And we'll see what we've got. But I'm really looking forward to September onward, even though all my muscles are aching from doing all this damn work, getting ready for the winter. We're going to have some cool stuff. Sorry. That's not the last thing. One last thing here. An addendum to it all. We're getting our Proa ready. We'll be launching here, I think, soon. By that, I mean within, say, 45 or 60 days. There's still a lot of work left, but the end is in sight. And so if you've got Arduino particularly, but if you've got research projects that would benefit from being launched into Puget Sound, get in contact with us, because we're going to be doing some of the research projects here ourselves. And if you're a frustrated estuarine oceanographer stuck in Kansas and you want to design and build a project, we'd be quite happy to set it loose for you. Just shout us up here at moon@halfpasthuman.com if you've got that kind of thing going. And we can see what's going to happen. No, it's a lightweight boat, so your project better be awful lightweight. I think my payload total is going to be somewhere around 1,000 pounds. so it's not like we can carry big gear, but we'll do our best. So anyway, until later, which will probably be a lot later given the level of work we've got here, get ready for the Ice Age. Watch out for all them lying sons of bitches. Check your primary documents. Watch out for the shift of the weather. And who the hell knows what Ison is, but it probably ain't a comet. The planet is expanding. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. and think about everything in reverse, in the sense that the oceans are the new part, guys, not the old part. And when you put that into perspective and wrap your head around that, it gives you all kinds of interesting views of the planet. And if you've got a, you know, a use for these iron plumes and that kind of thing, hey, you're going to have a whole lot of fun, because they're going to be popping up all over. Watch out for sinkholes. You can check your areas and through local geological surveys and this kind of a deal, and see what your risk levels are, so you know ahead of time. By the way, I do expect the weather to slam in on the West Coast. It may help some of the fires here in Washington State and in California. How soon we're going to get the major blow, I don't know, but there's a lot of data for a big storm to hit us here. Hurricane kind of thing, you know, torrential rains, all of that sort of a deal. And we sure could use it. It's dry, dry, dry. Anyway, bye, bye, bye. Talk to you later.